This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. The fate of Terri Schiavo is now in the hands of a federal judge. The federal courts gained jurisdiction in the case of the brain-damaged woman after President Bush signed a law a few minutes after 1 o'clock this morning. The Senate approved that bill on a voice vote, and the House of Representatives held a heated debate last night that began with the dry language of congressional rules.
What purpose does the gentleman from Wisconsin rise?
Speaker, I move to suspend the rules and pass the bill, Senate 686, a bill for the relief of the parents of Teresa Marie Schiavo.
The clerk will report the title of the bill.
Senate 686, an act for the relief of the parents of Teresa Marie Schiavo.
Pursuant to the order of the House today, the gentleman from Wisconsin, Mr. Sensenbrenner, and the gentleman from Florida, Mr. Wexler, each will control 90 minutes. The chair recognizes the gentleman from Wisconsin.
Speaker, I ask unanimous consent that all members may have 5 legislative days within which to revise and extend their remarks and include extraneous material on Senate 686, the bill currently under consideration.
Without objection.
Speaker, I yield myself such time as I may consume.
Then, for more than 3 hours, member after member took to the House floor to speak passionately about life, about death, about the horrible conflicting decisions that families face in this country every day. Democrats and Republicans wrestled with an issue that is more commonly debated in hospital corridors with distraught families and doctors, when many times no one knows what exactly the right decision is. Since the late night session went well past the bedtimes of many newspapers and many listeners, we're going to listen to excerpts from this debate, and we begin with the gentleman from Wisconsin, the first congressman on the floor, Republican James Sensenbrenner, chairman of the House Judiciary Committee.
The measure of a nation's commitment to the sanctity of life is reflected in its laws, and to the extent those laws honor and defend its most vulnerable citizens. When a person's intentions regarding whether to receive life-saving treatment are unclear, the responsibility of a compassionate nation is to affirm that person's right to life. In our deeds and in our public actions, we must build a culture of life that welcomes and defends all human life. The compassionate traditions and highest values of our country command us to action. We must work diligently not only to help Terri Schiavo continue her own fight for life, but to join the fight of all those who have lost the capacity to fight on their own. As millions of Americans observed the beginning of Holy Week this Palm Sunday, we are reminded that every life has purpose and none is without meaning. The battle to defend the preciousness of every life in a culture that respects and defends life is not only Terri's fight, but it is America's fight.
Congressman Sensenbrenner was followed by Florida Democrat Debbie Wasserman Schultz, who criticized the intervention of Congress.
Do we really want to set the precedent of this great body, the United States Congress, to insert ourselves in the middle of families' private matters all across America? If we do this, we will end up throwing life, end-of-life decisions into utter and complete chaos. And we can't and should not do that. We are members of Congress. We are not doctors. We are not medical experts. We're not bioethicists. We are members of Congress. When I ran for Congress, I didn't ask my constituents for the right to insert myself in their private, personal family decisions, and they don't want me to make those for them. They don't want you to make those for them either. That's the bottom line. I can't get into the kinds of questions that we're being asked to get into here because we don't know. We don't know. I've never met Michael Schiavo or Terri Schiavo or the Schindlers, and the vast majority of people in this body haven't either. We don't have the expertise or the facts in enough detail to get into these kinds of decisions and make decisions on these kinds of cases. We're not God, and we're not Terri Schiavo's husband, sister, brother, uncle, or relation. We're members of Congress. We make laws, and we uphold the law, and we swore to uphold and protect the Constitution, and we are thumbing our nose at the Constitution if we do this here tonight. Now, I've heard a lot of things said about this legislation and about the very proceeding that we're engaging in this evening. I've heard accusations that because this body is debating this legislation, we are threatening somehow the life of Ms. Schiavo. I think it's really important to note that this is a legislative body created by our forefathers for the express purpose of deliberation and representation. The accusation that because we have 3 hours of debate on an unprecedented piece of legislation that seeks to insert the federal government in between a family while overruling state courts and circumventing the Constitution, that's an outrageous accusation and not worthy of a representative elected to craft and debate legislation.
Some representatives argued that the reinsertion of Terry Schiavo's feeding tube goes directly to the purpose of the United States government. Republican Trent Franks of Arizona.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, and thank you, Mr. Chairman, for your humanity and courage to deal with this issue. Mr. Speaker, perhaps it is important for those of us in this chamber to first remind ourselves again of why we are really all here. Thomas Jefferson said the care of human life and its happiness, and not its destruction, is the chief and only object of good government. Mr. Speaker, protecting the lives of our innocent citizens and their constitutional rights is why we are all here. The phrase in the 14th Amendment capsulizes our entire Constitution. It says, "No state shall deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law." It is unconscionable that judges holding responsibility to protect Terry Schiavo's constitutional rights have chosen to abandon those responsibilities, so now that Congress has no honorable alternative but to respond as we are. Hubert Humphrey once said that a society is measured by how it treats those in the dawn of life, those in the shadows of life, and those in the twilight of life. It is true that Terry Schiavo lives among us in the shadows of life, but she is not brain dead or comatose. She is awake and she is able to hear. She's able to see. She's often alert. She can feel pain. She interacts with her environment. She laughs. She cries. She expresses joy when her parents visit her and sorrow when they leave. And, Mr. Speaker, she reminds me so much of another woman whose name I will not mention, who was in much the same circumstance as Terry. And a young nurse insisted every morning on singing to this patient. And, of course, her colleagues upbraided her and said, "Well, she can't hear you. Those are just reflex actions." But she continued day after day, year after year, to sing to her every morning. And finally, she left the hospital, and yet a few years later, the patient regained her state of mind and came back, as it were, to a healthy, clear mind. And all of the nurses gathered around her and met with her, and they said, "Do you remember? Do you remember when we took care of you, when we turned you to keep you from getting bed sores, when we washed you, when we tried to feed you?" And she said, "No, I don't remember anything except someone singing." Mr. Speaker, Terry Schiavo represents the mortality and helplessness of us all as human beings. And whether we realize it or not, we are at this moment lying down beside her, listening for that song of hope. And if we as a nation subject her to the torture and agony of starving and thirsting to death while her brother, her mother, and her father are forced to watch, we will scar our own souls.
Democratic Congressman Brian Baird of Washington State brought his prior experience as a medical professional to the floor.
"I don't know what to do tonight. I honestly don't. If Terry Schiavo were here, she could tell us what she would like her fate to be under this circumstance. Those who say that we are condemning her to death by starvation, that may be so if action isn't taken tonight. But it may also be so that you may be condemning her to a life that she might not choose were she here to choose that. Some of us have spoken on both sides of the aisle of holding our loved ones in our hands as they died, having made the decision not to have heroic measures. For 23 years before working in this body, I served as a clinical neuropsychologist. I have been with many patients in persistent vegetative state. I wish life were different. I really wish it were. I will tell you the stories like Mr. Franks and others about sudden recoveries where people almost miraculously or magically are better and return to their former state are apocryphal for the most part. After years of coma, people do not return to to who they were before. What happens is we have a brainstem that is miraculously robust at protecting breathing and heart rate, but it is our cortex that makes us who we are, and that cortex dies when it is deprived of oxygen, and we effectively die with it. And I am sorry about that. It is so tragic. I honestly don't know what to do. But for anybody to try to imply the people on one side or the other don't care about this woman is just not right or fair on either side. This is an American tragedy, but more importantly, it's a personal tragedy. And people on both sides are pro-life in the richness and complexity and difficulty of it. Some are trying to do their best to honor what they believe are this woman's wishes to not live condemned to a bed where she cannot speak or enjoy the higher virtues of life that she might choose. And if she did indeed say, "I would not choose the fate of being condemned to this bed," then we are denying her that right to make the choice. That's the challenge here tonight, my friends. But let no one who leaves this body somehow imply that whichever the vote is taken, one side or the other doesn't respect life in its richness. We are all pro-life. We all feel for this family.
After the debate, the House of Representatives passed the bill on a vote of 203-58. President Bush was awakened to sign it. Today on Talk of the Nation, we'll discuss ethics at the end of life. Countless Americans face agonizingly difficult choices. Medical professionals try to help. If you've had to make this kind of decision as a family member, as a patient, as a doctor or a nurse, give us a call. 1-800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. You can also send us an email. The address is TOTN@NPR.org. After the break, end-of-life decisions are the talk of the nation. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. The Terri Schiavo case falls at the center of a perfect storm of cultural concern and political belief, but the fundamental situation is hauntingly familiar to many of us. As medical technology advances, decisions about life and death are increasingly forced onto patients and, in situations of incapacitation, onto their families. The law tries to answer some of these tough questions with living wills and advanced directives, but the hard choices happen every day. Terri Schiavo's family is not the first to wrestle with differing medical and religious beliefs or to have emotional decisions caught up in already strained relationships. For the rest of this hour, we want to hear from those of you who've been involved in this kind of decision. If you've had to make a choice about whether to end the life of a loved one or not, especially in a situation where family members disagreed, give us a call. If you're a health professional, a doctor, nurse, social worker, or hospice worker, what happens in those rooms? How have you tried to help? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is TOTN@NPR.org. And joining us are two doctors who deal with these kinds of questions every day. Dr. Ezekiel Emanuel is chair of the Clinical Bioethics Department at the Warren G. Magnuson Clinical Center, which is part of the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda, Maryland. He's also an oncologist and joins us here in Studio 3A. Thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you.
Also with us is Dr. Eric Steele, a family physician and vice president for patient services at the Eastern Maine Medical Center. He's at the studios of Maine Public Broadcasting in Bangor. Welcome to you as well.
Thanks very much.
And Dr. Steele, why don't we begin with you? You frequently see families dealing with these kinds of decisions. Is there a case that you can tell us about to illustrate some of the things that they go through?
Sure. A number of them. I had a patient not too long ago who had one kidney because he lost the other kidney to tuberculosis as a very young man. He developed cancer in the remaining kidney. And the question for him was whether to have that kidney removed and the cancer with it and to go on dialysis for his remaining days or to not have the procedure and to die as the result of the cancer much sooner than probably he would have. And he is otherwise otherwise healthy 80-plus-year-old, and, of course, a compelling, extremely difficult decision for he and for his family. And initially they had some disagreement about which way to proceed. He ultimately chose not to have the surgery and died not long after that. And one of the concerns I had was that someone in his family, once he slipped into a coma as the result of his kidney failing with the tumor in it, would be that someone would change their mind and try and reverse that decision. A very tough issue. Ultimately, he died without intervention. But we see this issue every day. And when family members disagree about it, if you can work through that, things may go well. If you can't, it can simply tear a family apart, as it's doing in this case.
Dr. Emanuel, a cancer doctor, an oncologist, you see patients dealing with terminal illnesses all the time. Do they generally make their decisions in advance? Do they change their minds, as Dr. Steele was worried about in this other case?
Patients are all different, and they do it all different ways. A lot of patients have thought through these issues, and some come in to you with an advance directive. Many of them haven't, although almost all the cancer patients I've had have thought about the end of their life because they have cancer and they realize that they very well could die from it. But they sometimes don't come to closure, and even when they've made up their mind, their family hasn't necessarily accepted it also, and so you do need to discuss that.
Mm-hmm.
But
When it comes to do not resuscitate orders or artificial means of survival of ventilators, that sort of thing, how much can we choose what happens to us at the end of our lives?
It really depends how you die and what kind of interventions are necessary. A lot of these interventions can be used on patients, but increasingly in America, most patients are dying with decisions not to get resuscitated, not to have heroic measures or artificial respiration, artificial hydration, dialysis involved. I mean, we know that about 50% of Americans now die outside the hospital. And for most of those, the decision's already been made that they're not going to have everything done, as it were. And even many patients in the hospital don't get resuscitated. We know that now about 90% of patients who die in the intensive care unit have care withdrawn or withheld.
Mm-hmm. And Dr. Steele, is it your experience that there are conversations ahead of time that people know is everybody on the same page?
Boy, often they are, especially if there's been time for the patient to be involved. It's more often when something suddenly has gone awry that there may not have been that kind of conversation. And very often in those cases, there is disagreement, especially early on, about what course should be taken. There may be disagreement among the physicians, in fact, about what course should be taken. Physicians will sometimes disagree about prognosis for a given problem, and they sometimes will register what may seem to be and may actually be the differences of opinion about the likelihood of whether a patient will survive a given problem. That, in turn, can magnify family disagreements about what course should be taken. So one family member who really wants everything done will just hold on tightly to the physician who sounds a little more optimistic, and another family member who thinks, well, this is not what they would have wanted, will hold on to the more bleak prognosis. So physician disagreement can play a huge role here.
And Dr. Emanuel, if the physicians disagree, the family disagrees, there has never been a case like the Schiavo case, the amount of publicity and the amount of review that's gone into it, but most of us don't get that kind of review. Caution, if there's disagreement among the doctors, would seem to be a helpful path to take.
Yes, usually when there's disagreement among the healthcare team, it's because they're uncertain about the prognosis and whether the patient will recover, and then caution is the right mode. I would say and echo what Dr. Steele has said, which is that typically it's the uncertain cases where an accident happens or an uncertain untoward events happen where people haven't prepared that you get the most disagreement. And that, ironically enough, often happens with young people. Almost all the famous cases that we remember, the Karen Ann Quinlan case, the Nancy Cruzan case, the Terry Schiavo case, are young people where an unexpected accident happened and there really hadn't been a lot of discussion and thought to this. And then you get a lot of disagreement involved. I would say, though, a lot of Americans, whether they've talked with other people or not, have thought about the issue. And polling shows a sort of consistent that the vast majority of Americans do not want to be kept alive by medical interventions if they're in a persistent vegetative state or in a coma for a long time. Mm-hmm. And that's a very consistent finding over the last 15 years.
If I could just add, picking up on Dr. Emanuel's comments, one of the paradoxes of this issue is that it's almost more important for younger people, young healthy adults. At 48, I still include myself in that category. Young healthy adults need to have this conversation.
He's the optimistic doctor,
isn't
he?
Yes, I'm very optimistic. It's more, almost more important for young healthy adults to have this conversation than it is for the elderly with terminal or, you know, like diagnoses like cancer, because for the young otherwise healthy adult, the young man in terribly head injured in the car crash or the other cases that Dr. Emanuel has mentioned, there's where often it is the most difficult for families to make these decisions. So in some ways, the younger you are, almost more important for you to have this discussion at least than perhaps if you're older.
We want to hear from you. Many of you have had experience with these situations in your lifetime. Many of you are medical professionals of one sort or another, participated in these kinds of discussions. 800-989-8255. Email totn@npr.org. We'll begin with Hal, who's calling from Salisbury, North Carolina.
I do. This event this week has been a real flashback for me because 20 years ago I had this happen when my wife was terminally ill. She'd started out with breast cancer, which metastasized to her brain, and there was medication which was keeping her alive. And still with me?
Yep.
Okay. The it got to the point, well, when it became clear that the only option remaining was terminal care, then we went to a hospital, and the physician there introduced the idea of the DNR, the Do Not Resuscitate order, which I had not heard about before. By this time, my wife had suffered so much, and we had talked about it. She had had cancer, although after the cancer developed, we had not had this conversation much because a cancer patient frequently doesn't have the ability to talk about, you know, the bad outcome, the death outcome. I wanted to. When we started talking about the DNR order, which was essentially to be passive, to let things proceed, I pushed for actually withholding the medication, which would hasten demise. The outcome would not change. The only thing we were arguing, we were discussing, was the timing. And her mother did not agree with that, and the attending physician was not comfortable with it either. And although the decision was legally mine,
mm-hmm.
I remembered something that my wife had said. She had been a gifted counselor, and one time many years ago she said, "Don't push the river, let it flow." So I made the decision just to essentially do nothing, to be passive about it, although it could have continued, I think, for some long period of time. Ultimately, I signed the DNR order,
mm-hmm.
and she had pneumonia, which developed, and in the course of treatments for the pneumonia, she just stopped breathing one day,
yeah.
and they took no further action.
Hal, let me ask you, after all this time, do you have any regrets? Have you thought back on it? Did you get enough advice? Did you talk to enough people? Did you think about this long enough before you made your decision?
Well, we had had considerable time to talk, although in the terminal phase, it's like the person who was most important to me in the world was my wife, the person that I wanted to talk to most.
Yeah.
And she was not available for this discussion. And but we had a minister with whom we had worked, who did not give advice, who just provided spiritual support, and knew that it was really my decision based upon on my view of faith at the time.
Yeah.
And so we did have time to talk and time to reflect. That is true in all of these cases. Of course, I didn't have years to reflect on it, but this had the situation had gone bad over a period of several months, and there was quite a bit of time.
Yeah. Hal, thank you very much. We appreciate it. It was obviously an extremely difficult situation, a wrenching moment in your life. We appreciate you taking the time to call us.
Right, and it won't stop being wrenching. I don't think this is 20 years since, and whenever the families make these calls, it's going to be with them. I just grieve for the people that are having to deal with this in a public way. It's a tragedy.
Hal, thanks very much for the call.
Good day.
We're speaking with our listeners and also with Doctors Ezekiel Emanuel and Eric Steele about the ethics of the end of life. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Dr. Emanuel, I wanted to ask you about Hal's call. There's a lot of people in that situation.
There are a lot of people in that situation, and I would say that he said that this happened 20 years ago. That's 1984, and at that time we were really in the midst of a national discussion and a lot of legal cases. It's the state court level trying to understand what the country should do. Over the course, really until 1990, when the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in the Cruzan case, there was a lot of national discussion and deliberation about that. And the Cruzan case sort of set a national consensus, and the Supreme Court recognized the consensus that many people do want to terminate treatment, that they have a constitutional right to terminate treatment. And I think with that decision, the medical field, doctors, nurses, as well as the public, became very comfortable in recognizing that that could be the right thing to do in the right circumstances. And it went beyond do not resuscitate. That is one element where if a patient stops breathing or the heart stops, you go in and try to restart it. Do not resuscitate says we're not going to do that. There's also the possibility of withdrawing or withholding, not even starting treatments that might be life-sustaining, like blood transfusions or antibiotics. And again, those stopping or not starting those things have become quite common, and I would say the norm for most deaths in America. It is not the unusual situation anymore, and I think the American public has become comfortable recognizing that. What they haven't, I mean, being comfortable recognizing that you can do it doesn't make the decision any less emotionally wrenching. And like Dr. Steele said, you know, every practicing doctor, and especially oncologist, has scores, if not hundreds, of cases, and all of them have unique aspects. And
yeah, I was going to ask Dr. Steele, the thing that Hal talked about was he was uncomfortable with the idea of including something in the medication that would slow down the breathing. I'm taking a wild guess. This was morphine, probably. There's a difference between withholding something and doing something.
That's such a crucial question, and not only for obviously those involved in this debate, the active versus passive life-sustaining measures. It's a key issue for families as well. Very often, families are more uncomfortable withdrawing something or stopping a treatment than they are with not initiating it in the first place. For example, I'll have a patient or a family who will say, I don't ever want to be put on a ventilator. On the other hand, once the patient is on the ventilator, it's frequently harder for family to make that decision to turn that switch off. In fact, it's sometimes harder for staff as well, for physicians and nurses and others involved in the patient's care team. So sometimes that whole issue around what you initiate versus what you terminate magnifies some of these end-of-life decisions and the difficulty for families making them.
Can I pick up a couple of points that Dr. Steele said? First of all, he's absolutely right. Psychologically, it's very difficult. Ethically, however, there is no difference between stopping something and starting and not starting it. Mm-hmm. But that also shouldn't be confused with euthanasia, where you actually inject something to actively end a life. That is not what the caller, Hal, was talking about, and that's not what's present in this case at all.
We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we will take more of your calls on this question. We're going to take this out to the end of the show. Our guest, Dr. Ezekiel Emanuel, who you just heard, chair of the Department of Clinical Bioethics at the Warren Magnuson Clinical Center at the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda, Maryland, and Dr. Eric Steele, a family physician and vice president for patient services at Eastern Maine's Medical Center in Bangor, Maine. Back with them and more of your calls, 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is TOTN@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. Back after the break, you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Now let's continue our discussion on end-of-life situations. How do real families, with all of their flaws, conflicts, and concerns, come to a decision about keeping incapacitated ones, loved ones alive or let them go? Our number, if you'd like to join the conversation, is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. Our guests are Dr. Ezekiel Emanuel, chair of the Department of Clinical Bioethics at the Warren Magnuson Center at the National Institutes of Health. He's an oncologist. And Dr. Eric Steele, a family physician and vice president for patient services at Eastern Maine's Medical Center in Bangor, Maine. Let's get another caller on the line. And this is Bob. Bob's calling from Reno, Nevada.
Yeah, Neil. My mother died about 3 years ago, technically from Parkinson's disease. She'd asked me earlier on, or told me earlier on, she didn't want any heroic measures taken. But when she was put in the hospital, which she had the flu, and then it turned into pneumonia, and they'd put a feeding tube in her to try to get antibiotics down, I noticed that they took the feeding tube out, and I was just livid. And I went up, and I went around the floors, and I was bothering all the doctors and everybody. It turned out Mom had an administrator, and apparently she had told that person that she didn't want to live. And they, in my opinion, they more or less followed her will in this matter. And as a family member, and the administrator wasn't, I was really, really concerned. And I kept asking, well, what part of her isn't treatable? What part of this disease isn't treatable? She was taking morphine. And what eventually happened was her bun level rose up and her kidneys shut down and she died. And I was just overwhelmed with that because, you know, I encourage anyone out there who has an elderly member of the family who may go into this situation to really think through just exactly how they feel about that person's death and what kind of measures should be taken to keep them alive. Because I wasn't at all prepared for it, Neil. I have COPD, and I almost died as a result of this. In fact, I was referred to hospice care myself, and I had to make those decisions by my doctor. So I just really appreciate what you're doing here, and thanks so much.
Well, appreciate the call, Bob.
You bet.
Bob, again, this situation is not unusual.
Actually, there's a famous case from Massachusetts called Lane versus Candura, where a mother had a gangrene of the leg and did not want it amputated, and the daughter very much was not reconciled to her mother's death and sued to get the courts to declare her incompetent so the daughter could approve the amputation of the gangrene leg. And the court said very explicitly, it's the mother's body, it's the mother who decides if she's competent. If she's mentally incapacitated, it's another issue. So these are not that unusual circumstances where a competent patient and their children aren't ready to let their parents go. And I know I even have, when we discuss in my family, my middle daughter is very anxious every time I say what my wishes are and the fact that I don't want life-sustaining treatments. It makes her very, very nervous.
Here's an email from Todd in Scottsdale, Arizona. My mom went into cardiac arrest while in the hospital for another illness. By the time I got there, she was already in the ICU on a respirator and a million other machines and in a drug-induced coma. She had a living will specifically stating no extraordinary measures were to be taken to prolong her life. She suffers from a chronic and painful disease. My father and I were nervous. Not only would she pull through and in what condition would her mind be in, but also wondering how mad she would be at her present condition. When she was finally released from the hospital and rehab at home 9 months later, she changed her living will to say extraordinary measures were okay for a period of 90 days. The Schiavo case, Dr. Steele, people are telling us, well, go out and make a living will. Make your intentions known. In a lot of cases, not just Todd's mother, they don't seem to pay attention to living wills.
Boy, this is a real challenge. a couple points. One is that often what patients want, and specifically when they express an intention of what they want, they will often change their mind. This issue has been studied. Patients will change their mind about DNR status. Their circumstance may change. And so what they think about when they make out their living will and what they're willing to have and not have may change. So it can be a moving target. In addition to which, sometimes a patient will have a living will. They'll end up in a state like Terry Schiavo or one of the others that we've talked about. And a family member will then come along and have a very different perspective or belief on what should be done. When that family member then makes those feelings known and may resist the intent to withdraw care, sometimes the medical personnel will become anxious about the repercussions of following through on the patient's expressed intent. And they may pause. They, in some circumstances, may not follow through on the intent. And this gets back to Bob's point. I think it's very important for people to understand if the patient expresses their intent, then that patient's intent becomes the legally binding determinant of what the medical professionals are supposed to do. It's not your right to turn around and tell the medical professionals what to do when your mother, for example, has been very clear on what she wants.
Mm-hmm. As I think Dr. Steele was talking about, Dr. Emanuel, sometimes doctors are concerned about the legal implications of what they're doing.
Yes, I think there has been concern about the legal implications and frequently the sort of psychology of minimizing lawsuits. I always tell doctors, even though I'm not a lawyer, but as an ethicist, the most important thing is to do the right thing and let the legal chips fall where they may. Because if you do the right thing, people are going to rally to your side. And I would emphasize, as that email suggested, the medical system hasn't been good about transmitting advanced directives. We know that if you have an advanced directive in your nursing home and you get transferred to the hospital, frequently the advanced directive doesn't go there. Even if it's in the record, the doctor might not read it. And so the whole medical profession has a responsibility to become much more proactive about using these things and about knowing what they say when they're in the chart.
Mm. Let's go now to Len. Len's calling from Tucson, Arizona.
Yes, Neil. My mother died at 89. From cancer. She expressed her wishes to the doctor, but she was allowed or permitted rather quickly to starve to death. She had pancreatic cancer. It was very swift because of her age. But my sister had cancer in her early 50s. She was on morphine, and it was clear that she was terminal. And once again, the system demanded that she not be given excess morphine, but that she be allowed to starve to death. We could not understand why she was put through the last week and a half of incredible discomfort, I'm sure, because the system didn't recognize that there was no way out.
Are you saying they didn't give her enough morphine to keep her comfortable or didn't give her enough morphine to put her under?
They gave her enough morphine to be comfortable, except as she got sicker and demanded more, some of the medical people found or stated that there were limitations on how much they should give her. And no, they did not give her enough to terminate her life or when it was obvious that it would have been much more comfortable for her, her children, and everybody, other member of the family.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Steele, is this something you're familiar with?
Yes, absolutely. Sometimes physicians are reluctant to give enough morphine to really take care of that pain at the end of life because the dose that it can take to control the pain may be a dose that suppresses respiration to the point that the patient could expire. I suspect Dr. Emanuel has had even more of these cases than I've been familiar with. And I think it's really unfortunate when that happens, that fear of sort of killing the patient, being causing euthanasia, interferes with the ability to really adequately control the patient's pain.
Dr. Emanuel, you're shaking your head.
Yes. Well, more than 100 years ago, there was an exchange of letters in the British medical journal, The Lancet, where a doctor said, could I give morphine to a patient, even if it caused respiratory depression, to relieve their pain? And the editors wrote back very sternly and said, your obligation is comfort measures for the patient, and even if it causes respiratory depression. That being said, and that is the obligation, it's been recognized as the obligation for more than 100 years. It's legally protected for doctors to do that, to treat the pain. It's very difficult to actually overdose a patient on morphine once they've gotten some. Their system becomes habituated to it. So the most important thing for medical professionals, nurses, doctors, and everyone else is to treat the pain and not to worry about the respiratory depression. The body has mechanisms to prevent that. And even if it doesn't, you're legally protected if your focus is on treating the pain.
And if I could add, 100 years after that exchange of letters, if you have a doctor who still has a problem with giving enough to treat the pain, get another doctor.
Here's an email from Janelle Thomas in Reno, Nevada. I believed at one time I wouldn't want a feeding tube placed in me so that I would not starve to death. But a few years ago, I stood by my husband's side while his grandmother died at the age of 96 years old. The hospice assistants gave us a wonderful pamphlet that described what the dying process is like and that stopping eating is just part of the dying process. We have since changed our wills to decline the use of feeding tubes if we are not expected to lead a productive life in the future. And again, as we look at this incident case of Terry Schiavo, is it common for feeding tubes to be removed, Dr. Emanuel?
Yes, it's common for feeding tubes to be removed, and it's not painful either. Most patients are insensate and don't actually have sensation of hunger or of thirst. So that's especially if they're either in coma or persistent vegetative state. So while we use the word starve to death, and that has connotations of someone suffering a great deal, that's not actually what dying patients experience. And I would say more frequently, it's the fact that people don't start artificial nutrition and hydration. I think that's the much more common situation where patient stops eating and then they just don't start it.
We're talking about the ethics of the end of life, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And here's another caller. Rachel's calling from Portland, Oregon.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
A few years ago, before the Death with Dignity Act was initiated in my state, my aunt died. Only her brainstem was active. And we all were in agreement about what we wanted to have done, but we were also told that her brainstem might keep her alive a lot longer after the life support system was removed. So when the nurse came in and told us that we could ask for morphine as often as we wished, as often as we thought she was in pain, we all knew what that implied, and we were all very, very grateful and thankful for this one woman who was probably breaking the law, but really saved our family a lot of heartache and difficulty. It took about 6 hours, and then my aunt passed away.
And when you're saying you all knew the implications, more morphine would make it more difficult to breathe, this would hasten the end?
Yes, okay. Yes, we all knew, and the nurse definitely implied that we could come as often as we wished.
Mm-hmm.
So we went about every 15 minutes.
And in the end, you were all grateful for that?
Absolutely, absolutely. We had gone through this years before with another family member. There was some confusion about what she wanted, whether or not she would be able to recover. In the end, she died, and it was a long, excruciating process, and
mm-hmm.
we all knew we didn't want to go through that again.
Dr. Steele, is it your experience in Maine that from time to time nurses or doctors will say, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, here's how to go about it?
It does happen sometimes. I don't know if it happens often. I think we try all to hang on to the thread of treating patient comfort. It's a moral thread. It's a legal thread. And so in that effort to keep the patient comfortable, we may also hasten their demise. But I think there have been surveys of physicians. Most of us have been in such circumstances. And it does not happen infrequently, I'd say. I suspect Dr. Emanuel has seen a number of cases like that.
Dr. Emanuel?
Well, actually, euthanasia, either by increasing the morphine or active means, is pretty infrequent. The most frequent specialty to do it is oncologists, but even there, only about 1 in 10 have done it. They've received a lot of requests. And I think it's a pretty rare circumstance, despite all the attention. I mean, even if you look at a place like the Netherlands, where it's been legalized for many years and permitted before that, only about 3% of deaths are by euthanasia. The fact is the vast majority of deaths, even at a place which legalizes it, are not going to be by euthanasia. And if we want to improve care, I think it's best to focus on care at the end of life for the vast majority of people, and that's not going to be vis-a-vis euthanasia or assisted suicide.
Rachel, thank you very much. We appreciate the phone call.
Thank you.
Here's an email we'll end with. From Arch. My mother has been tube-fed and in a persistent vegetative state as a result of late-stage Parkinson's and has been attended to daily by my father at her side for the past 5 years, while my sister, who's a doctor, has always insisted against this type of intervention, and her professional disagreement flies against the obvious benefit my father and I gain by the opportunity for a long goodbye with our mom. Sure, we all realize that my mother's time is very limited, and we're not looking for her to be the vibrant person of past memory. However, it's very easy to see that there is a vital connection still there, and by attending to her, it gives us all an important feeling of being close to her and giving some last little comfort and care as a way of saying thanks for a lifetime of the comfort and care we received from her. And just to finish up, Dr. Emanuel, everybody is different.
People are very different. They have different values. They have different sense of what's meaningful in life for them. The one thing that gets me a little nervous about that expression is making her a means to your end rather than her as the end and her life as the end that it should be. And I think we've got to be very careful that what we're concerned about is that person and not what it's doing for us.
The case of Terri Schiavo has been shifted to federal court as a result of the bill that passed Congress last night and was signed by President Bush early this morning. A hearing in the case is scheduled to get underway in Tampa, Florida in a few minutes. Stay tuned to NPR News for coverage as it develops. Dr. Ezekiel Emanuel, thank you very much for being with us. He's chair of the Clinical Bioethics Department at the Warren Magnuson Clinical Center at NIH. He was here with us in Studio 3A. Dr. Eric Steele, thank you for your time today. He joined us from Maine Public Broadcasting in Bangor. This is NPR News.